Welcome to episode 2 of the Marky Microwave podcast. This episode is the second half of our conversation about Marky's growth and evolution from a small-scale mixer manufacturer to a diversified MMIC technology company. In this installment, Doug and Chris discuss the fundamental differences between the hybrid and IC business model, how Marky strategically positioned itself to compete in the semiconductor area, and what it takes to design elite RF products for the most demanding customers in the world.
So at the end of the last episode, we were talking about the diode supply and how that drove changes from the traditional hybrid, you know, the 50-year-old hybrid mixer model to the MMIC device model that we're using today. So can you explain the difference between the supply chain for the MMIC, the microlithic or a hybrid mixer versus the supply chain for a MMIC, an arbitrary MMIC?
Yeah, so this is critical to understanding the calculus behind the plan to move to MMIC. Because we had so many issues with hybrid supply chain, specifically with the diodes, but it went beyond that. Basically, everything on the bill of materials that we needed to buy to make a hybrid mixer was at various times of our history at danger or in danger. The MMIC supply chain is a lot different because it's essentially just one company, a foundry, who builds the product, and then you take those die and you package them yourself, or you give, you know, sell them directly to the customer as bare die, or you put them into some kind of surface mount package like a QFN. So fundamentally, the supply chain of MMIC is 90% die or foundry, and then maybe 10% other. But with a hybrid mixer,
services,
it's
yeah
and then there's the services associated with it, which is much more, I would say, diverse, and you have more options. So you're not as sole sourced. Well, you're very sole sourced with the foundry.
Yeah.
You cannot just easily port foundries, as you know, Hittite discovered.
Right.
Prior to the sale to Analog. But the main difference is that there are more suppliers needed to buy the materials to make a hybrid mixer than for a MMIC.
And you're sensitive to all of those suppliers.
And every single one of them matters, and you're constantly playing whack-a-mole with which item on the bill of materials is causing the performance degradation you're seeing, or is it your own fault because your assembler skill is a part of the quality.
Right.
Whereas in a MMIC, it's pretty much, did the foundry build it properly?
Well, and the foundry only has to do it once. This is an operations change that was really huge for the company, which is that when you build a hybrid mixer or even a microlithic mixer, you build them 100 at a time. Whereas when you build a MMIC mixer, you build them as many as you can at a time, at least one wafer's worth. And typically you build more than a wafer. So you really only have to get it right during that short window of time when the parts are being fabricated, and then you just have them indefinitely.
Yeah. Once you have the blueprints, you can make as many as you want.
Right.
And you can scale really at the push of a button, which is, how many wafers do I buy?
Yeah. So they're pretty dramatic differences in terms of the operations side of the company that I want to talk about in a little bit. But from a design standpoint, is there a dramatic difference in the way that you, like, imagine that you have a requirement or an idea for a coupler versus an idea for a MMIC mixer or some other MMIC product? Is there a big difference in the design process between those two types of products?
That's okay. Well, you're asking that because you know it's loaded. The answer, I mean, we could have a 4-hour discussion on this because it's like, I suppose, a passion of ours. Okay. The simple answer is, well, it depends on the engineer, is really the answer. If you're my dad, you design by instinct and empirical prototyping. And that was the ethos of, let's say, his era, where you didn't have as good of access to simulation tools. Like, there were some, but maybe they took forever to solve. So the answer to how you design a coupler versus an IC or something like that comes down to the engineer. If you're my dad, you design by intuition and empirical evidence. You build prototypes, you play with the prototypes in the bench, and you hack and burn until you get what you like, and then you try to recreate that. And that is literally how almost all the components came to be in his era, from, you know, filters to mixers to couplers. Everybody had their own kind of hacks, and they were physical hacks, not software hacks.
Yeah.
And so you could get away with that for a long time. My dad got away with that his entire career. He's never used a computer to design anything. I came into the paradigm where everything is simulated, or you expect to simulate the majority of what you do, because the simulation tools are good enough and the computers are fast enough to where it's worth it to invest almost all your time in the software. So the answer is, for me, the jump to going from couplers to microlithics to mimics was seamless and inconsequential, because everything built on itself. I had already been designing in 3D for all of my passive products, and we had invested a lot of money and time in getting HFSS up to speed and learning how to integrate Microwave Office into what we do. And so really there was no extra amount of work when it came to simulating IC mixers, except that we came to understand that simulating IC mixers was far more accurate than simulating every other mixer we'd ever done, because the diode models were rock solid and they were produced wafer after wafer after wafer exactly the same way, or at least from our perspective, they were identical. Maybe if you're a CMOS guy, you're just like, oh, wow, this process wanders. But to a parts gallium arsenide, we're talking about parts per thousand, maybe.
Yeah.
So we do not experience the problem at all. And what this meant was that we started to think a lot more about investing more and more time in simulation all the way down to the junction of the device.
Yeah. And this is something that I'm not sure if this is... I don't know how applicable this is outside of microwave, if microwave might be the sweet spot. I remember when I was learning like microwave classes in undergrad, the professor would describe how you could take a line and trim it with a knife. And I thought that that was the most bizarre thing that I'd ever heard, that somebody would take a circuit and a knife and like carve it out and make, try to improve a circuit that way. Because you can't really do that with a DC circuit, because the exact shape of things doesn't matter. And you can't do that in optics, because you have to, the fabrication tolerances have to be so fine.
Yep.
And I think this is coming from the optics world into microwaves, it was shocking that the simulations were so accurate, because in optics, I imagine that the simulations are just as accurate. Like Maxwell's equations work at every scale.
But you can't build it.
But you can never build it.
Right.
Yeah. Like fabrication tolerance.
The fab tolerance on the optical circuit you're doing are like so bad that you're guessing half the time. And we experience that a lot, right? Like every time you'd read an optics paper, you'd be like, that's, what did we use? OpSim or something? Or VPI?
Yeah.
Is the thing we used at the time. And we all took it with a grain of salt.
Yeah. Well, and if you got into nonlinear device modeling, like in a laser, a semiconductor laser, there were like 500 different terms describing the optoelectronic interaction compared to a transistor model. You know, transistor models are complex enough with self-heating and with all the parasitics and if you start to get into capacitances with the wafer. But the optical, when you add an optical element to it, it becomes completely unmanageable. And the papers would have like 500 different terms in them. But you were doing passive simulations.
Right.
And in passive simulations, it's just Maxwell's equations. And
it's pretty much perfect.
Yeah, you're done. And it doesn't matter. The drawing on your screen could be a chip, or it could be a coupler. Theoretically, it could be
It could be in inches antenna. Or it could be in microns. And it looks the same on the screen. It didn't matter to me. Yeah.
Yeah. You get into problems sometimes because you look at a drawing and you're like, it's only 5 mils, but you think that it's sufficient, and then you realize when you actually fabricate it that you were drawing something extremely small that can't be fabricated by any assembler.
Right. Yeah. And so this is why, when it all really okay, so this comes down to, you hadn't asked the question yet. I'm gonna lead the witness. So you bring up. Okay, so if you can establish that simulating couplers or simulating mimic amplifiers is essentially the same tool set, then what you start to say is, okay, well, why don't you design the most expensive thing you can make that you can sell the most of? Because you're roughly agnostic, right? You're a microwave engineer. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Which, of course, we know is not true, but that question comes up inevitably if you have success with this design cycle. So if we all have access to the same foundries, because they're, well, not always actually. Okay, so we can talk about that as a separate problem.
Supply chain.
But which, you know, if you're locked into a particular foundry, you have to choose your prom date carefully. And what separates you from some other smart engineer who also owns CST or HFSS or ADS, whatever the simulation tool du jour is, what separates the men from the boys, or, you know, the elite all-stars from the bench players in the RF design space? And in my view, the answer is the ability to complete the design cycle accurately and measure what you simulate.
So how do you do that?
It's an iterative process of careful attention to detail with the ability to understand the packaging aspects of it. So, and we come across this a lot when we interview students, is that and I think we'll devote a lot of time on this podcast to talking directly to students about the fact that they're never going to design anything.
Yeah.
Unless they learn like far beyond what they learned in undergrad. And so the design process, or say the product development process, ends far after, like a year after the final simulation is done. So the first 10% of the work is the simulation, in my view, if you're really rolling out a good product.
I mean, after you've reviewed the literature and,
well, yeah, okay, you know, I'm assuming
and once you are a world expert on the topic, then, well, you start your design.
Yeah, you can't become a designer until you're a world expert at something, right. In my opinion, this is the other thing that I think students totally don't understand, is it'll take you 4 years of reading papers to finally maybe come up with one slightly original idea, unless you're a genius. Like, unless you're at the highest level of an engineer in their early 20s, you're not going to have an original idea. And even people in their 30s don't really have original ideas. They usually just come up with the same similar concept to something that was done in 1965.
So cute.
Right. It's so novel, right? And of course, then they patent it and waste everybody's time and pay lawyers. But
get a bonus.
Yeah. But the point I'm making is that what separates the best designers, and I use that the general term designer, is they understand what the tools can do, what the limitations of those tools are, and then they understand when they build the piece of hardware, because we're in the hardware business, right? We're not in the software business. So you have to build the thing and verify that your simulation worked. We got very, very good at that in the first, let's say, 5 to 7 years I was here.
What? So you say that it's very important to get confirmation between the simulation that you do and the measurement. What are the pitfalls that an engineer coming out of undergrad would typically fall into when doing a design that would make it not match up with their expected result?
Okay, so there are many. Okay, so there are a couple areas that I like to grill students on when we interview them. The first one is just talking about the simple idea that basic circuit elements don't act like basic circuit elements at microwave frequencies. Right. So that's just the basic fundamental physics of our field, which is that once the wavelength becomes comparable to the part or the circuitry that the energy is flowing through, weird things tend to happen, like capacitors stop acting like pure capacitors and inductors start looking like weirdly capacitive, and It's in some tools. So some simulations will exhibit this and some will not. It depends on the approach you're taking. And so you have to understand the weaknesses of the simulator to really be gifted or highly effective using them. And that takes many, many years. So you can't come out of school and just know, like, oh, a spiral inductor is not really an inductor after a certain frequency. Okay, fine. Oh, and the Q got terrible. Okay, and it's physically too large, and now all kinds of weird coupling issues are happening, and my thing no longer looks like a low-pass filter anymore.
Right.
So that's one. The other thing, and this is something that we learned over time, if you take enough care to simulate, especially in 3D, because 3D is kind of like the truth-telling serum. If you simulate something in 3D and it still looks good, and then you don't measure it like that, it's almost always the measurement's fault. And this is something that we learned through time, and I can't tell you how many engineers have come up to me and you and handed us measurements where we knew they measured it wrong, right, because it didn't match the simulation. Yeah. And they're adamant that they measured it correctly. And then you say, yeah, there's a second harmonic leaking through because it's the synthesizer's not as clean as you think it is, buddy.
Yeah. Or there's a packaging problem where the connector is loose.
It's always the connector. Like, that's, yeah.
Blame the connector.
Blame the ground. Ground is mother.
Yeah, the ground is not, the ground isn't soldered properly.
Yeah.
And I think it's weird being in, like, I'm going back to the idea that this 3D simulations, and specifically, you know, the finite element method simulations, the HFSS simulations that we use, are rare in almost all of engineering because they are, it's like God's own truth bestowed on you from the heavens. I can't think of another arena, because any other simulation you do is an abstraction, and certainly 3D simulations are an abstraction. But if you're talking about like 2.5D method of moments, or especially like a circuit schematic, or if you go up another level to the system simulators like Genesis, each time you get more removed from a component, from the component, you add a level of abstraction that obscures some kind of non-ideality.
You've made an approximation.
Yeah, you're making an approximation.
I think that's the best way to put it is, like, you know, if you come from an applied physics background like we do,
yeah,
every class you take in grad school, the professor at some point says, okay, these are our assumptions. Mm-hmm. And they'll write up a series of parameters, and then it'll be like, this one's much, much greater than that one. Yeah. So we cancel that denominator.
Yeah.
Or, like, you know, it's everything becomes like some mathematical, like, flow down to a very simple equation. But we know that in reality, all these other complicated things are happening. It's just that the variables were orders of magnitude larger or smaller than others. In HFSS, you never have to do that. It basically calculates everything for you.
Yeah, if you're careful.
But, you know, we don't take certain things into account. We pretty much ignore almost always anisotropy in the substrate. And you apparently informed me last week that is not always true. Like, Rogers told you that?
It may or may, it requires further study to know whether this is affecting
Mr. Coonrod says so.
Yeah, John Coonrod.
So we ignore that.
Yeah.
We ignore surface roughness almost always. But you can simulate that.
But, well, there are things that are simulatable, and there are things that are... There are always things that are unknowable.
Right.
What is the exact thickness of each metal? You know, you have to still make approximations just to get the circuit to be drawable.
Well, and that's a really... Okay, so that's a really good point. Even with the HFSS, you're still making approximations. So by going through these design cycles many times, over time I learned which ones mattered and which ones didn't.
Yeah.
And so, like, you're always making this optimization between speed and accuracy in your design flow. And I learned which ones were really helpful and which ones I could throw away. So I almost do them, you know, by instinct now. I don't think about it when I'm clicking certain buttons in the menu. I don't even know I'm clicking them anymore, right? It's like, oh, you uncheck that box, obviously. Oh, it just makes it go faster. I don't even remember why. Because like 10 years ago, I compared A, B, and it was fine. So that wasn't obvious. So when I started doing mimics, it wasn't obvious which tricks I could play and which ones I couldn't. Like, what is the exact stack up on a conformally coated dielectric that goes over some kind of metal layer. Well, it's not planarized.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is maybe really esoteric if you haven't done this kind of work before. So the idea is this. If you have a piece of metal deposited on a semiconductor and it gets etched, you have like these areas where there's metal and areas that are not. Well, then they deposit a plastic on top, like a dielectric layer, or they, you know, it could be silicon nitride or polyimide, yeah. And it kind of coats everything, and it still exhibits some of the topology of the metal beneath it. Some processes, they'll planarize it. Some of them won't. The question is, does it matter? And how do you simulate that? That was really not clear to me when I started doing this. And because you could simulate these things and you'd be like, oh, well, it'll change the balun, you know, phase balance.
Yeah.
Or it'll change like which optimal width of the line I use. So over time, like, you know, you do this enough times and you just start like intuitively saying, ah, I know what to do.
Well, and you do experiments for each one, right? It's like I simulate it with and I simulate it without. One time I take the time to go through and actually do the work of making this more accurate, and it doesn't make a difference. So then in the future I don't do that.
Yep.
And it's the same way for doing measurements, for doing characterization.
Right.
One time you do the measurement with a filter, the next time you're in that exact same situation, you know whether you need to do that or not.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very general rule for all engineers to understand. Yep. Is that...
That's a universal lesson. Yeah. So you've described the scientific method and you isolate variables and change things and you monitor what happens. I'm pretty shocked how many people don't really have that skill coming out of school.
Well, but I would say this is not the scientific method. This is the engineering method, which is what can you ignore? What parts of science are you allowed to ignore and still have a functioning widget at mm-hmm. the end?
Yeah. Because as an engineer, you don't need to know all the science. No. You just need to know what matters for the task at hand.
Right. Well, this is the opposite problem that I feel like PhDs have coming out, which is that they feel like they need to know everything to get before they have a product out the door. And in engineering, you don't need to know everything. You need to know enough to make a viable product that the market wants.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't need to know everything possible.
Right.
So how do you make the distinction between, like, one of the first blog posts that I remember you writing was know when to shoot the engineer.
I don't think I actually used those words.
I believe the publication would not allow it.
Well, no, I didn't. Yeah, well, we can talk about that some other day. But that is such a charged statement. That's a phrase that my dad's engineering staff used describing when they were like WJ about when they were gonna, you know, complete a design and just, you know, put it into production.
Yeah.
So I mean, obviously back in those days the it was a different climate of, you know, offensiveness and, but also like, you know, there weren't as many shootings, I guess. But
not
so,
as public.
So we had, so maybe it's a know when to fire the engineer might be a better we could call it that. But it's colorful. So
we do not advocate the hunting of engineers for sport or any other reason.
No. Be kind to your engineers and let them out of the dungeon. Big companies run by MBAs, let them out of the dungeon. Like, they're nice people. What's the question?
When do you fire the engineer?
When do I fire the engineer?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's like, when do I fire myself? And then since I'm also like, back in the day, I was also the business development person.
Yeah. You've done many, many generations of mixers, and you could have...
Yeah.
You could have not released many of them.
Okay, that, you know, I don't have a good answer for that. Let's see. The truth is that when I'm doing my own work, whenever I decide that I've done something good enough, maybe when my degree of self-loathing is so high that I can't take it anymore, and I'm so disgusted by my inability to make great product that I'm just like, okay, it's good enough.
Fine.
There is an aspect to that, like this I think really good designers have that, like, nothing's quite good enough. It's like, you know, Elliott Smith, the musician, who's like a, you know, brilliant songwriter, the most depressed person ever, like may have been murdered, but probably committed suicide. That guy, like, if you ever watch him in an interview, it's like he acts like he's the worst person to ever touch a guitar. And you listen to his music and it makes you want to cry. You're like, he's like John Lennon reincarnated. He's amazing. I think that good designers do that. You're never satisfied. You always think, ah, like, you know, I can hear the flat, the B flat is just a little flatter than I want. So that happens. So you fire the engineer and go to tape out. When you decide that you're no longer making any really fruitful progress and you're wasting the company's money. And this comes down really to a business problem that engineers need to understand, which is the company's paying for your time.
Right.
This is not your playground sandbox to make any fun HFSS model you want and then pound on it till the cows come home. You have to do something useful with your time. And so there becomes a, there's always some time in the design flow where the return on your hours of simulation don't pay off anymore. But you've come far enough down the road to where you've done a couple novel things. That's when it's time to fire yourself and say, okay, we're going to move to the next step of building this thing.
Yeah. A couple novel things.
A couple novel things at a time. Learn as you go. Assume you're going to learn something when you build it that you didn't originally understand. That's all you have to do.
Now, so you mentioned the never good enough self-loathing side of designing, but you also believe that you have to have a certain ego to be a good designer.
Well, so, aren't ego and self-loathing like kind of related?
Yeah, I mean, what's the what's the relationship? What's the balance?
Oh, I think they're kind of like the same thing.
The same thing?
Well, for me, they are.
You hate your stuff less bad than you hate everybody else's stuff.
Yeah. I'm highly motivated by negative feelings. So like, you know, like competition, like animus towards competition really drives me. I don't know if like, you know, I've met some designers who are just like the nicest people and I don't get that. it's like, how do you get up in the morning and like deadlift 500 pounds of, you know, HFSS?
Drive yourself into it.
Yeah, like I'm much more like the Rocky style training, you know, running up a mountain. In fact, when I run, I actually think about things like that. I'm like, I think about how I'm staying in shape to get more energy to design better, which is really, really weird and nerdy.
I think that's from what I understand, the best way to maintain your mental acuity, right? Improve cardiovascular. You know, blood flow.
Certainly, I feel better like when I do it. But okay, so is there a relationship between ego, but also like the fear of failure? I think there has to be, because you wouldn't be doing it. You wouldn't be trying to become a great designer if you didn't feel like you could win at it. Or win might not be the right word, but become successful, compensated, gain some level of respect from your peers, get a lot of personal satisfaction out of achieving something. I mean, it's like achieving anything in life. If you want to become a great piano player, you're going to sacrifice, but you wouldn't sacrifice if you didn't think there was a payoff.
Right.
Everybody's payoff of why they do it's probably a little bit different. But part of getting better is fully appreciating how bad you are. Like, and this is, I think we circle back to like talking to like interviewees a lot, but it's always like meeting an interviewee who has no idea how bad they are. It's always the worst candidate. It's just like, God, you just don't know all the things you don't know yet.
Yeah.
And so it's like ego without self-loathing is a dangerous thing.
It's very, very bad. Very dangerous. Well, I think that for mimic design in particular, you know, you talk about winning and the motivations that, that drive you behind it. And I think that that's, well, for a lot of microwave people, they do what they do because they love the work. And that's why I think why you see so many, especially founders in of microwave companies,
that are still around way after they have earned their retirement and could be off on a beach somewhere. Mm-hmm. And they're still coming into work every day because that's what they want to do and that's what makes them feel good. But to the mimic economy, you know, we talk about how we're a hardware company, but in a lot of ways, mimics are a lot like software in that you have to do the design once and then you can replicate your work an arbitrary number of times.
If you're a mimic designer, your output is like a GDS file.
Yeah.
One GDS which is software.
File. Yeah.
So you are a producer of a software product.
Yeah.
It's just it turns out that software product can become hardware actualized at a foundry. But you don't need the engineer for that.
Right.
And that means that when I say fire the engineer, that's actually literally what happens to some people. And how many mimic designers have we met who used to work at, you know, some major place?
Yeah.
And it's like, why would you have ever left? Oh, they probably didn't need you anymore because they already had your amp.
Yeah.
They completed
their line of VCOs
and it
was time to see the door.
That's right.
And I think that this is very, there's a big difference between a mimic design and, like you could say, if you're a designer of any product, once you have the design, you're done, right? But if you designed a car, they would keep you around until, for as long as the car was in production, because there are inevitably going to be problems. There's going to be tires that you can't source, and they're going to need to consult with somebody on which tire they can get as a replacement. But when you've got mimics, you can print 20,000 at a time or 50,000 at a time. The problems are that the processes are so much more dialed down at foundries that it becomes more than a difference of degree. It becomes a difference in kind where you really don't need the designer anymore. And so when you're talking about winning at mimic design, you really do need to win. You can't make the second best, the third best design, mm-hmm. because there's no reason, you know, it doesn't cost any more to make the best design than the second best design. So there is no reason for a customer to choose the second best design. So one design, it's like, why would you use the second best search engine? It's free. It costs the same amount. Yeah. That's why Google has so much money. Why would you use the second best mimic when the best mimic costs the same amount?
Right.
So it's very much a winner take
all. Well, you use the word cost, I think you meant price. It's the same price, but the cost is the same.
Right.
So it costs Markey the exact same amount of money to develop a mimic mixer as it does, you know, competitor X. Well, that's not entirely true because I can do it a lot faster because I have libraries and libraries of designs. But when I was starting from zero, I was actually at a deficit in terms of how much it cost me in my time. But when it comes to the actual direct cost of the material,
right,
we're in the exact same boat. So then it's all about performance, because if we're all going to have the same cost structure, then you have to sell on some other metric than cost. And so that's going to be mostly the performance. But then, you know, over time, especially here, we're going to be doing a lot more value added capabilities like software support, integration, reliability. These other things are obviously valuable to the customer, and so we focus on them heavily. But because we have no cost advantage, it pushes us into those other categories to differentiate.
Right. Well, I was careful not to say price, because price and cost are very different things, and materials cost for this isn't private information, this is public information. Look at any semiconductor company on Yahoo Finance, look at their income statement, their balance sheet. Their gross margins are going to be pretty good, and their overall margins are not going to be significantly better than other companies in other sectors. And the reasons are because it is the manufacturing cost to produce a semiconductor is low, but there are a lot of other costs associated. And I think that one of the major things that we didn't realize going into Mimic, becoming a mimic company, is that you're trading a manufacturing problem and a one supply chain problem for a very big alternative supply chain problem, which is inventory management. Mm-hmm. And trying to figure out, you know, when you can order 40,000 of something at, that you don't have never sold, and you have to buy potentially several years worth of inventory of a product that you have no idea whether there's a market for or not. That's a very tricky thing to do.
You're making much bigger bets.
Yes.
It's just fundamentally. When you go into a cost model where all of your development costs are up front and there's really no redos or do-overs. Well, there are redo-overs. There are spinning new masks.
Yeah.
But you're going to... The board of directors may, you know, cut your whole division if you do that too many times. So you have to be really careful. And this came back, you know, this comes back to the whole question of why didn't I do Mimic sooner? In hindsight, I wish I had. But there's no way I could have justified the bet. It's like playing limit poker.
Yeah.
Like the first time I went to Bay 101, I was like, I was playing 2-4s or 2-4. And then I went to like 3-6. And then as I started to become good at poker and I actually had some money, I was like, oh, let's go play 6-12. Like, that's exactly the same way that I took you know, the Mimic flow. Careful wagering of money to make sure that I could still, you know, have gas money to make it home.
That's what I did with stocks. I started off, you know,
with the cheapest stock.
I was buying like $500 in stock in grad school. You know, I'd get a hunch and I'd buy like, or I'd get something that I thought was some kind of tip on a stock, and I kept like doubling my money on $1,000 stocks or whatever, or buying $1,000 worth of stock until. I finally was like, all right, now I'm going to make some big bets. And now I'm just going to invest in the S&P 500 for the remaining number of my career.
I mean, I definitely learned that I was not going to be a stock guy when when I bought, I think, 20 shares of Google when it was like IPO.
Yeah.
And I think I made like 30% profit in like a couple months.
You're like, wow.
And I sold it. I was like, I'm going to book this.
I'm going to buy myself something nice.
Yeah. It was like all the money I had, too.
Yeah, yeah. Not smarter than Wall Street.
I think I made like $300. I was like, this is awesome.
Yeah. So what are the other differences between the being a Mimic process company and being a more traditional microwave company?
I don't know. What do you think the differences are? I don't think there are that many.
I think it's pretty dramatic.
Okay, so let's go down the list. How about that? Let's go down the list of what's the difference between being a fabless IC business versus a hybrid component house? Is it?
Yeah, we could say a hybrid switch, you know, manufacturer.
So, okay. Software tools, identical.
Yeah.
Measurement equipment, mostly identical.
Measurement equipment, yeah, completely identical.
Okay, which is like one of the biggest barriers to entry to becoming a microwave company the measurement equipment.
Getting back to why couldn't people do Mimics before? During the last episode, we talked about why didn't, why were mixers not more advanced in the 90s? I was arguing that the software tools were not as good.
Yeah.
I also think that the measurement equipment... Measurements were much, much more laborious, particularly on nonlinear devices. Even at the beginning of my career, 10 years ago. The advances, I wonder what we're going to be capable of 10 years in the future, because you can already almost completely characterize the nonlinear metrics of a mixer. If you are careful about setting up the template, you can measure them immediately. If you're willing to spend, you know, $500,000 on a test setup from a major test equipment manufacturer. But basically the same.
Okay.
Yeah. The same between a hybrid company and a Mimic company.
Well, I think it would be faster to say what are the differences.
You cannot...
Supply chain is a huge difference. How you structure your supply chain has got to be different.
Yeah, like supply chain is obviously like the very biggest thing. You have to do much more planning, much more careful assessment of. So, imagine that you were, bill engineer, a brilliant designer of some product, and you wanted to start a company. say you wanted to start a, say you're a switch designer and you wanted to start a hybrid switch company versus being a mimic switch designer starting a mimic switch company. If you want to start a hybrid switch company, you probably need to spend $10,000 to build your first switch. You buy right. some diodes yeah. or pin diodes or whatever you buy. You get some aluminum housings machined for you know, a couple $1,000s from any machine shop. You buy some circuits. You buy some connectors.
Yeah.
And you got your first set of 10 switches made almost immediately for short lead times and not much money.
Mm-hmm.
Getting to the next 10,000 takes a long time. If you're a mimic switch designer, then step one is buy layout software. How are you going to make the drawings?
Yeah.
Because you can make the drawings for, we make drawings.
Well,
for,
no, I would even say it starts before that. It's talk to a foundry and ask if they'd even be willing to do business with you.
See because, if they'll answer your calls.
Yeah, like I remember calling TriQuint. This is like maybe like let's say a year before we committed fully to making Mimics.
It's when they were TriQuint.
And I called up TriQuint and I was like, "Hi, I'm Chris Markey of Markey Microwave," thinking that would help, you know. Like, it's like my name's on the, you know, on the marquee.
Yeah. I'm the guy.
I'm like the son of the guy.
Yeah.
And I have power to spend money if you will allow me. And I was like, I want to do mimics with you guys because I heard other people are doing mimics with you. Yeah, that's true, Chris. So how many hundreds of wafers will you run per month? And I go, 0.01 every year would be my starting R&D budget. And he hung up the phone.
Slightly under.
Yeah. So that was like, and that was shocking to me because I figured that, you know, like, why would you ever turn down a customer? That yeah. didn't make sense to me because I never would turn down customers. And
yeah.
to this day, probably should more than I do. But, like, you know, I just think projects are interesting.
Yeah.
Like, especially when it's somebody I hadn't talked to before who may have something to teach me about something they know. But, yeah, they just hung up. And you've had this experience with silicon germanium, I think, right? Yeah. Markey Microwave of today has been rejected by, you know, silicon germanium people. And you're like, really, guys? Like, are we still not good looking enough to get yeah. a drink bought for us? Like,
yeah, it's a clue
what the heck, man?
When like four business development managers show up to a meeting and you're like, I was planning on like, you know, maybe trying something out.
Yeah.
And they're like, how many thousands of wafers do you plan to run per week? And I told
so
them
so which handset
my
is
estimate.
This for? Which base and, station or handset is this for? They don't even bother asking about like the application. They just assume it's
yeah,
going
yeah.
to be commercial.
Is this like a router or more of a modem?
Is it a Wi-Fi
yeah.
for like
yeah.
a
drone? And it reminded me of the scene from the Big Lebowski where he's at the funeral parlor and they're like, sir, this is our most modest receptacle. They pointed me to their most modest process.
They actually show you like, you know, a completely different company.
Yeah.
They're like, these guys sell discrete silicon diodes. You might just want to toy around with those, little yeah. boy.
Yeah. They directed me to a distributor of foundry services.
Oh, yeah. That's good.
Moses. Yeah. I want to describe a process. We've been using the term process, and this is something that I wanted to make a distinction between mimics and other types of vendors. So typically when you... As a hybrid component company, when you're trying to make a product, either you're making a housing or you're making a circuit or you're using, you know, well, devices are more commodities. But when you're making a drawing for a housing or a circuit, you come up with what you want and then you basically like call the production manager on the phone and or you send the drawing over and some guy, probably named like Scott or John, looks it over. And it's like, this corner's too tight. You're going to have to give me some more relief there. And this thing is, I don't like the angle of this. So, and that plating is no good. We can probably only do, well, maybe we can do that plating. We'll try it.
It's negotiable.
It's all negotiable.
Everything's negotiable.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
whatever you can get him to sign up for. And he may or may not, probably may not be able to produce that 6 months from now. But he'll, you know, he'll do what he can do to get the business. And that's part of the reason that you run into so many problems is because getting hard and fast rules about what they'll supply from most vendors is difficult because they don't necessarily know. When you go to a semiconductor foundry, a pure play foundry, they know exactly what they will sign up for, and they have it in a document called their design rule document, their process guide. And it's per process. So they have a process that has a device on it. The device might be a transistor. It might be like a bipolar transistor or a PHEMT transistor. And they know exactly what they're going to do, and they know what devices they can include with it, what types of resistors they can do, what kind of crossovers they can do. And they have rules for every single aspect of how you lay out the circuit. And when you send in your file, they don't have a guy that looks at it and is like, maybe it'll work, we'll try it. They run software on the design, and the software tells them whether you have violated any of the rules. And the rules are constantly updated, and they run a qualification on the process, and then the process is the process. And the bigger the foundry is, the more the process is the process, the less variation they will tolerate within their process.
Yep.
To the point where when you get to a, this is what makes
it. So it's rigid, but beautiful and clean. It's like.
Yeah, you know exactly what you're going to get.
It's essentially a piece of perfectly written software.
Yeah.
It's.
Yeah, it softwareizes
it. It softwareizes the whole development process, which is why, you know, there's, I'm sure that there's a relationship here between how perfect design rule checks are and the fact that you can fire an IC engineer after you have his mask.
Yeah.
Because it's like, makes you expect. I have the software. The software checked my software. I have a product now. We don't need you anymore.
Yeah. Well, I think what you've described is the paradigm of the modern economy, which is anything that can be converted into an algorithm can be made by a computer and fire the guy that does it.
That's right. So there's a paradox. I can't remember what it, there's some paradox that some guy came up with in AI, and the paradox is something like the more complicated and white collar the job is, the more likely it's going to be AI'd.
Yeah.
And the lower level the job, like let's say like janitorial services, the less likely AI is going to fix that anytime soon. Mm-hmm. So there's a paradox, and you can see it perfectly with what we do. Like, I think,
absolutely.
Like right now I'm writing scripting to design filters, and I'm trying to fire myself out of the entire algorithm because it's like, I do the same thing over and over again manually. I don't need to do this manually.
Yeah.
And the best designers, especially the best IC designers, I think, understand this. And they write their own scripting toolboxes, and they have a toolkit. And they roll around with this toolkit, and they whip out these specialized jackhammers to hammer out designs very quickly.
Yeah.
That are at the highest level.
So that's another problem for an undergrad angling for a design job, is that your toolkit is empty.
Yeah.
All you have is what your professor gave you in undergrad, which was probably ADS, because ADS or AWR, you know, they're free for students. Mm-hmm. They're actually, you know, in addition to home scripting, which, you know, everybody's got their own home scripts, there are professional companies, which are typically one dude, one software person, or one, like, microwave person that's written some scripts. And when you work on a computer program for an entire career, you can make an incredibly good computer program to solve closed-ended problems like impedance matching. Or filter design, or, you know, that first part, if you've learned how to design a filter in ADS as an undergrad, you have learned to do what software already knows how to do extremely well. Mm-hmm. It's like when they teach you how to do a Fourier transform. Like, nobody pays you to do a Fourier transform because we've got software to do that now.
Nobody will get a job designing filters the way they do in ADS in school.
Yeah, yeah.
If you want to be a pro, if you want to do Bush League stuff, you can do it. But if you want to make your money as a professional filter designer, there are people out there who've already done everything. The Simpsons already did it. So, because foundries are basically perfect, or as perfect as you can really hope to get, I think, with hardware.
They'll do what they sign up to do.
They do what they sign up to do. And the hybrid, the hybrid component supply chain is not like that.
Yeah.
So that is a major paradigm difference. And I think what it's done is it spoiled us in the realization of working with foundries versus working with, let's say, some PCB vendors.
Yeah.
I don't want them to get mad at me, but, like, you know, it can be a nightmare.
I think every PCB vendor is who you're describing with. So anybody listening that is a PCB vendor, I cannot name a PCB vendor that we have had a seamless relationship with.
No, that's true.
Even the good ones that we love,
yeah,
there are always fights and breakups. And then you realize that every other PCB vendor has their own flaws, and you go back to the one that brought you.
yeah, and there's only so many, so you don't have, like, you can't just, you know, burn the bridge. You have to stay diplomatic.
Yeah. Now, but this is something that I worry about, that is a risk that we are exposed to as a MMIC company, that is not a risk the risk is that everybody has the access to the same processes. The processes are advertised. There are only a handful of foundries.
And it's not in the foundries.
Who they are.
It's not in the foundries' interest to not make it widely accessible. Yeah.
They won't make you a special pro.
No.
They might make you a special pro. Some of them might make you a special process, but they won't. You know, how many millions of dollars would you have to pay them to keep?
How many hundreds of wafers, Doug, are you going to be running per month? Then they'll consider it.
Hello, is this Apple?
Yeah.
Oh, who, Mike? Microwave? Yeah. Can you spell that?
Some Apple engineers are listening to this and be like, oh, those little chumps.
Yeah.
Taiwan Semi is listening to everything we ask.
I remember when I was an intern at Intel, and they had Semicon, you know, so everybody was like, oh, you got to go up to Semicon West. You just show the blue badge, man. You can get on anywhere. I was like, where do I want to go up there?
Yeah, we pay for our drinks, don't we?
yeah. But yeah, if everybody, so when you are a hybrid component company, when you're a boutique company, your supply chain is a competitive advantage. You don't reveal your suppliers because you have literally spent money, like thousands of dollars, bringing that supplier up to the quality standards, that, and a lot of times teaching them how to make your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Working through the
if you're at the cutting edge of an RF microwave design, you are pushing them harder than they like to be pushed. And this is why this is why Marky, uniquely as a RF microwave company, has issues with PCB, because we don't buy FR4.
Yeah.
We buy advanced laminates, and they're harder to work with, and there's lot-to-lot variations and all these things. And yeah, so that's a good point. Like, so your supply chain is both your advantage and your curse.
Yeah. I mean, things that are hard are competitive advantages, right?
Yes.
If they're necessary.
The more cutting edge it is, the fewer people can do it.
Yeah. Yeah, you're always, if they say that the tolerance is 2, then you're going to go to 2. You're not going to go to 3 or 4. You're going to go right up to what you can do, because there's some limiting factor on every design.
Right.
And a lot of times it's the coupling, the fabrication tolerance on the circuit. The coupling between two things.
Oh, okay. So I want to mention that. So you said, you know, if the limitation's 2, let's say gap spacing is 2 mil, whatever it might be. My advice to any young engineer listening to this, if the vendor says they can do a 2 mil gap comfortably, make it 3.
Yeah.
Because the thing that, when I was like a young designer talking to these vendors and, you know, thinking that everybody would tell me the truth, and they aren't.
Yeah.
They're trying to win the business. And, you know, I'm not talking to the process expert in the factory. I'm talking to the salesperson.
Yeah.
So know who you're talking to. The salesperson says they can do 2. They give the drawing to the process guy, and he's like, Bob, what the hell are you doing, man?
Come on, just do it this one time.
Yeah, do it the one time.
I got a customer.
So you get that first time, and it actually is 2.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, this is sweet. Let's make this a product. And then the next time it's like, no, it's not 2 anymore.
Yeah.
That happened with Microlithic. I think you know that story.
I think it's happened on a number of...
It hasn't happened. Has it ever happened with MMIC for us?
Well...
Not really.
Not for mimics, but for other circuit.
It's happened on thin film and it's happened on laminate.
Technologies.
Where, yeah, laminate. Where we got essentially like told that price went up because yields got bad because we followed their design rules.
Well, that's what happens is they can't not do it. They just double the price.
Yes.
Because the yield is half of what they expected.
Because the factory manager couldn't go home until midnight one night and he got really angry with the sales team.
Yeah. So we've been talking a lot about mimics and the transition to a mimic company, the transition to mimic processes. Is Marky a mimic only company? Is Marky another fabless IC company? Or if not, how do mimics fit into the larger frame of Marky Microwave?
Yeah, this is something that I think I actually talk about a lot internally. You know, what's our value compared to competitors? What do we do differently or specially that other people can't do or would take them a long time or a lot of money to compete on? And so the way I look at it is this. A lot of people know how to do hybrid components. You see a lot of smaller businesses that have been around for a long amount of time, you know, like kind of like my dad's era generation. They have their own small businesses and they're all successful. They can't do mimics because it's too hard to penetrate into. You have to spend a lot of time. Then there's the opposite company, which is the fabulous IC mimic company, usually some kind of spin-off of Hittite or
some designer
or, you know, a fired division of MACOM. Yeah. Which you know, you've seen several startups recently about that. And so you have the IC-based paradigm.
Yeah.
So we're a little bit unique in that we have both. And I think that's a tremendous advantage. So the reason that we do Mimic and the reason we got into Mimic was to secure our supply chain because we were worried about diodes. And it was also so that we could provide ourselves finally an internal roadmap for mixer development that could only be achieved through semiconductor, full-blown monolithic semiconductor. It would not have been sufficient just to convince a diode company to develop new devices. We had to get everything integrated and optimized in HFSS, really, to get the kind of performance that our customers want today. And you know, one of the byproducts of that, which we haven't even touched on, is the PDK we offer.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mentioned if we all have the same cost structure, then performance matters, but so does development speed. And so we're, to date, the only company in the world that offers nonlinear mixer models of all of our Mimic product. And so you plop it into Microwave Office or ADS, and you can probe this physics-based model quickly and easily and discover all kinds of things about the products that we didn't even know about. Because I didn't design for it. So the Mimic space is obviously where all the technology will drive, but you can't escape packaging.
Right.
And this circles back to the Achilles heel of all of these fabless semiconductor companies is they don't understand packaging. Maybe they do. Maybe I should give them more credit. But let's be honest, if you don't have a factory of 50 to 100 operators working with solder reflow ovens and working with pick and place machines and doing hand assembled product and working with all the different types of solder you can buy, you just don't have the skill set you need to support customers on their most challenging problems. And these days, those problems have to do with essentially swap reduction, right? So size, weight, power, and cost sometimes. But we're talking to customers who are miniaturizing their receivers by a factor of, what, 4 to 10?
Yeah.
And, you know, things that used to be on a credit card can now be on a quarter.
Yeah,
postage stamp. And so just being good at an IC design will not get you there. Like just having those GDS files that you send to a foundry to build you those wafers does not do you any good. Yeah. Because you still have to provide it to the customer in a way that they can use, which almost always is surface mount, right? But there's other things you can do. So what I look at is I say, okay, we have the factory that can do the packaging. We have the personnel, which we have the team that can do that. We have the ability to do our own internal reliability studies. And now we have the IC that has been developed over the past 5 years. When you marry those two, there's only, how many companies would you say possess both of those capabilities in-house in our industry?
I think there are two.
Us and ADI?
I think ADI outsources their packaging.
They do some of it in-house, I'm sure.
I'm sure that they have some capability. I don't think that they have the extent of capability that we've got.
And who else? MACOM?
I think Mini Circuits can do.
Oh, Mini Circuits.
A lot of packaging.
Well, okay, so I would say MACOM, Mini Circuits, ADI. Maybe ADI, because they, well, okay. ADI doesn't, I don't think, sell anything that touches, that's handmade. Is that, we'll have to ask somebody from
there. No, I think that's correct. MACOM sells things that are handmade, but I think that there's...
Yeah, they still sell mixers. They sell hybrid mixers to this day.
They do, but I think that they're almost a holding company in a lot of ways.
Like, well, as of this morning, I'm not quite sure what they are either.
I think there's. I think if you're an IC person,
we'll see when this airs. By the way, like, so yeah. we should mark the date. We're recording this on June 19th.
Yeah,
and that means that this morning was the announcement for a 20% layoff. By the time this reaches the airwaves, we don't know what Mr. Daly will do.
Well, we don't know what state the economy is going to be in, because there have been
Huawei.
There have been shockwaves from Huawei.
Oh yeah,
and especially in the electronic components industry, because it was specifically a ban of electronic components against the largest consumer of electronic components in the world. So I think that there's a lot of reverberations that are going to be echoing for many years. I think someday we'll be like, oh, that was right after the Huawei ban.
So Doug, how much money have we lost from this Huawei ban?
I think we had an order from Huawei.
Yeah. So,
I do believe we had.
I think we have to make a pre-announcement that we're down about $2,000.
Q3 results have been revised downward.
0.001%.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Marky is completely unaffected by this. So it's a really interesting position to be in.
It's an interesting idea, because it's a position of strength in a field of weakness, which is, you know, a promising place to be.
Yeah, well, I think it's actually a bad thing. I would prefer this, from a competitiveness point of view, to not happen, because I think what it's going to... The sharks will circle to now possibly go after some of our market.
Yeah, they will.
The thing that we like to work with may be appealing now to the people who got banned from Huawei.
Oh, I don't... I think it's going to shake out weak players, because, I mean, business is cyclical, and it's been a long time since we've had a downturn. It's been a long time since we've had a down cycle. And so even weak companies have been carried for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
I think in the next 4 years, I of our competitors, I think that many of them will close their doors, especially the newer ones. And
if there's a downturn,
other divisions will be removed. I think there's, it, at least in our industry, I think it's, I can't imagine. I'm going to claim June 19th, 2019. I'm going to stake my claim.
Is this the Jorgensen top?
The high water mark. Yes, this is the Jorgensen top. And I'm going to short I'm going to short our industry for the next several
years.
I mean,
ADI's multiple is pretty ridiculous. I know this because I own ADI, and I can't believe their multiple. But at the same time, it's like they're a monopoly on so many things.
I was just looking at Cree. If you think GaN is good, then you think Cree is great.
Yeah.
And Cree has not made money in 4 years.
Really?
I was shocked to see, because I thought for sure they would be...
All right, did you read those statements properly? Because you're going to get some hate mail from like the CFO.
I think that Cree, from the outside, Cree looks like a great company to me.
Yeah.
Like, they just look like they are pretty put together, and maybe I just don't know enough about Cree. Maybe they're a mess inside.
Well, but okay, but there's Cree, which is also like the lighting and all that, and then there's Wolfspeed, which is like the RF side, right?
Yeah.
I think the Wolfspeed side makes money.
they have revenue, but they don't disaggregate the costs. So they have like a $6 billion company market cap with $1.5 billion in revenue, and cost of revenue of like $1.2 billion. So, and then when you add R&D and SG&A, they're losing money, which I was confounded by.
I don't know.
Yeah. So, Jorgensen market top is now, and I think that there will be a struggle in the future. But the struggle's already taken out all of our weak hybrid component companies, competitors.
Yeah.
So that'll be a field of strength. What I think is interesting about the Mimic side of the company, whatever we are 4 years into the process, 4 years to 5 years down the road, is how much I've started to see Mimic as another tool in the toolbox, along with, if a customer comes with a problem, I think, can we do it with a Mimic? No, you can't do that with a Mimic because you have to mix processes, or because you have to, so you could do it with two Mimics, but then you have to bond them together somehow into a multi-chip module, or you can't do it with a Mimic at all because they need a power divider that goes down to 1 GHz. So you have to do that with some kind of other circuit, or you can do it in a Mimic. Like it's another way to solve the problem, which is in some ways, I think a specialty of ours, which is collecting the best possible ways to solve each problem.
Mm-hmm.
And having all of them at our disposal.
Yeah. We're technology agnostic.
Yeah.
With the upper limit being the cost of a particular development. Like, yeah. I would love to work on 45 nanometer SOI, but I'm not going to be spending $1 million on masks. And they won't answer my call anyway.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I look at silicon and I see chains, man.
That's true. For our business model, it's completely incompatible.
Yeah, it looks like a lot of work for what professors argue. This is an interesting like role between academia and commerce, in that professors have spent like the last 10 years developing the technology so that silicon can make what it used to require gallium arsenide. So SiGe and silicon. You look at a company like Analog Devices, and they're pretty much just promoting SiGe chips. As far as I can tell, they have left 3.5s behind them, or at least in the tail of their silicon development. And this has been developed by, like, the core IP has been created by a bunch of professors everywhere, who have been working feverishly on this for many years. And so in a way, it's weird that they've been, the government's sort of been subsidizing the decline of the 3.5 industry when it comes to these mass commercial products. But at the same time, the benefits, there should be tremendous benefits to the consumer because the silicon is so great. And I don't know, we'll see.
Well, there's benefits to the consumer above a certain threshold of volume. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing that, like, one day we should talk about the economics of the Mimic or IC space.
Yeah.
And maybe, like, it would be good if we could bring in somebody who was like a silicon expert, yeah, who really understood the costs, because we don't really know like what the cost is to do silicon germanium versus,
yeah,
SOI or whatever. We just know it's a lot. It's like an order of magnitude more than what we do today.
Right.
And so you just do some really simple economic, sunk cost versus, future earning,
yeah,
revenue. And you look how many months or years out you would expect to make a profit, and or how many widgets do you have to sell to make a profit?
Yeah,
what's your ASP, or average sale price of those particular widgets? And it's like, that's where I always get depressed and walk away from any silicon idea. Yeah. Because it just doesn't make sense for the small to medium volume customers.
Yeah. So on that point of what is the crossover point where you start to make money, I think that that's another big strength as a Mimic company, having packaging. Every time I've looked at the array of, so for every Mimic, almost every Mimic we offer in as a bare die, as a surface mount, and as a connectorized module. And I've considered the question of whether we should continue to do this. It's a lot of work to make a separate set of drawings, a lot of times a separate data sheet, have a separate inventory. A lot of our competitors will only offer a chip in a single package, surface mount or bare die, and rarely as a module, sometimes as an eval board. So why go through the effort? And what you see is there's still a lot of connectorized module projects out there. There are still a lot of companies, like, they're not companies, but projects, even at big companies, where they're making a small test system and they need 40 test systems. Is it worth making a surface mount board or a connectorized, will a connectorized system do? And so between hundreds of small projects, you can sell a lot of modules, and that lowers the crossover threshold for a new MMIC design significantly because of the higher revenue from the modules. And what that allows us to do that I think is a tremendous service to our customers is have a broader catalog. We can offer many, we can support many, many more chips because we can release them and pay off the development using the connectorized sales. And when you're making, when you're doing a design, selection is performance, because it's very difficult for us to predict a priori what, if there are multiple models that will cover a single requirement, say it's a frequency plan and you need a mixer. We don't really know which mixer is going to be the best until we measure them all or simulate them all.
Right.
We have to, you know, my favorite parts that I think are amazing sometimes suck.
Yeah.
For a given, you know, under a given circumstances. Sometimes they get beat in ways that you wouldn't expect. It's very difficult to make a part that's uniformly better across every spec. And so having that broad catalog and continuing to support the broad catalog, you know, is a big benefit of having all the packaging technology that we've got.
There's something else that you said it. It's like, so if you can offset the development costs through module sales, which captures it, you know, a really different customer set. Mm-hmm. It's like researchers, lab people. Yeah. I mean, how many modules did we buy in grad school? Like, I bought a lot of SHF equipment, so I spent $50,000 with those guys. And
two modules.
Yeah, I bought two modules for
$25,000 each. Yeah,
it is good stuff.
It is the best.
It's the best. But what that also does, and I think this is something that is completely underappreciated by our bigger rivals who only want to develop a chip for a, you know, seven-figure return, they aren't allowing their engineers to get creative and do weird things that may only sell two,
yeah,
but also may completely break the paradigm and give you something nobody's ever seen before. Like, we have things right now that, you know, we're not talking about them, but they'll see the light of day within the next 6 to 12 months that nobody has seen before. And the only reason I was able to even work on those designs was because we were making cash flow on previous designs.
Right.
And we got there much faster. We were able to iterate very fast because we had more than just chip sales and more than just QFN sales. We had module sales. And since we do it in-house, we could do it for an affordable price. And, you know, there you have it. So when you go and look at, I was just taking somebody on a tour today showing the reliability area where we're, you know, you're burning in these high power amps,
yeah,
that we're working on, and we're burning in these high linearity mixers that we're working on and beating the crap out of them in the ovens to make sure that they don't break in the field test. And I'm showing this guy the setup, and everything in there is a Marquee product.
Yeah.
So there's a Marquee power divider. It's like, you ever seen a Boomerang? Huh. There's this movie Boomerang with Eddie Murphy, I think. Yeah. It's a good movie, you should watch it, it's funny. But he's got like this uncle or like dad or somebody. He shows up like to like a dinner party and he coordinates everything. He's like, I got the mushroom shirt and the mushroom hat and the mushroom belt. So like, I always think of that. Like, it's such an esoteric reference, but somebody out there in podcast land is laughing because I got the Marquee power divider, and I got the Marquee amp, and I got the Marquee, yeah, whatever. The only thing in there that wasn't a Marquee product was like the cable.
Yeah,
you know,
like a cable.
But I had this whole setup. It was how many widgets are we burning in? Like 16 or something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
So, like, that setup with all the power dividers and all the amplification and all the whatever else is in there, couplers, you name it, that's probably a $30,000 setup.
Yeah.
That we did, well, for quote unquote free.
Yeah.
I don't know what the actual cost is, but the point is there are so many applications where the volumes aren't going to be great. But if you build an infrastructure based on really like well-designed and well-built product, it gives you this virtuous cycle of development that lets you go a lot faster over the time. And so, you know, that's how I started. My dad set the foundation, and I said, okay, what else can we build? And you just go from there. And so after a while, you start looking at the catalog. You're like, wow, we have a lot of product. And so that selection is what you're talking about. So the selection is your advantage. And it's kind of ironic that when people come to me and you and they ask for what the best mixer is for a particular application, we just don't know. And I think, I don't know if it makes us look bad or what, but we're honest and we say, the truth is, I can't tell you what the best 2x1 spur is going to be because it's going to depend on about 1,000 different things. Yeah. So you have two options. You can send us the frequency plan and we'll measure every mixer we can find for you.
Yeah, that fits.
And that was my dad's way. And we still do that to this day, right? That's a near continuous job at Marky Microwave.
First thing you learn as a engineer.
And inevitably they're going to screw up the 2x1 up. Yeah. And then, or we tell the customer, just go download the PDK and do it yourself because it'll be faster.
The self-serving reason behind the PDK that...
Oh, absolutely. Look, there's nothing wrong with being lazy.
Yeah.
We talk about this all the time with our own people.
Yeah.
Being lazy is a virtue, and doing things more than like three times is now you're just getting wasteful.
Yeah.
If you have to do something three times repeatedly, then automate the whole thing so you never have to do it again.
Yeah.
And that's what the PDK is. Now, we haven't written a script yet to cycle through. I was just thinking about this morning. So we, you know, you create your schematic with the frequency plan, you measure, and you want to cycle through all the different mixer options. There should be a button you can push.
Yeah.
That just, you know, files through every single option and then spits out the result.
Well, this was the ambitious early goal of the mixer calculator online. We had the PDK around the same time, and the initial idea, if you look at the mixer calculator, it has a drop-down box that says what spur model do you want to use.
Right.
And the only one in there is Bert Henderson's.
Yeah.
And it's a sort of patched version of that. But the original intent was to have a software backend where you could link up to the PDK and pull estimates of the spurs from.
Oh my God, I just thought of the best idea. All right, so you guys are listening to the magic as it happens. So here's the idea, Doug. So somebody goes into your spur calculator. They drop the frequency plan. And then they hit go or whatever, and it, you know, does the spur web or whatever GUI that they're using at that moment. And then there's a button at the bottom that says export this frequency plan to Microwave Office or ADS. It'll spit out, because you can transfer all of those data sets to a macro or a script, which can then import that and drop the entire mixer like measurement setup.
Yeah.
And then you can hit go to cycle through every single mixer that we have.
Would it export like an ADS file or an MWO file? Like a dot?
No, all you would need to know, schematic. Really all you're doing is you would be passing the fields of, you know, RF min, RF max, LO min, LO max, and IF out.
Oh yeah, and you've got a pre-made.
As long as you can populate those fields into a script, that script can then create the Microwave Office file.
Yeah.
Which then you would hit another script to say, find me the best Marquee mixer in the PDK for this particular spur. That would be really that for an experienced scripter, that's like a day of work.
Chris Markey,
yeah.
Script Kitty.
Yeah. yes. I'm lazy. I don't want to have to do this. Like it's
awesome. Like it's when you pretty, get it done, it's awesome.
It feels good when it's done, and it's boring as hell when you're doing it.
Getting back to the that layout example or the burn-in example you were giving, I always thought that was one of the most awesome things about being a an applications engineer here, is that you've got you can do $100,000 experiment with just the stuff that you've got sitting around. You go check out a few things from inventory, and you pick up some prototypes that haven't been released, and you can do the best possible experiment for it. You know, data communication system or whatever. You can make these giant elaborate experiments, and you suck up all the, you know, adapters in the lab, and everybody gets kind of mad at you over that. But you can do that because, as a component company, the broader, I don't think anybody else has an applications lab that has quite that capability, because
well, mini circuits.
But I don't think that they have their inventory under the same roof as their applications. Maybe they do. Maybe everybody's in Brooklyn, but I think that they're a little more. I think as the more capabilities you have, the bigger a company you are, the less access you have to each, you know, area in the company. But that
well, and they don't have a marquee power divider. Let's be honest.
They don't have the best power divider.
I didn't design their stuff, so I don't know. I can't vouch for it.
Not made here.
Not made here. Yeah.
But I think that that idea that, you know, you were saying you can make something that's really cool that's only going to sell two, kind of gets to the core of the ethos of the company versus a bigger company that is a money-making company. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah,
we're not really a money... I mean, we're a money-making company, and it's fun to make money. But we're not public. We're not designed to maximize shareholder value. There's no, you know, there's no legal obligation to maximize shareholder value. And so we can do things that are fun and cool and make awesome products without having a lot of stress over the fact that it didn't, you know, you're not going to get fired for having a product that didn't sell as well as you thought it would.
Yeah.
So it's a great product.
And I think we can put a capstone on this entire conversation with a pretty simple summary, which is that was always my dad's approach.
Yeah.
He did this to make money in the sense that he wanted enough money to remain free.
Yeah.
He was really just trying to buy his freedom to design what he wanted to work on and work on interesting products such that his family could eat.
Right? Yeah.
And in my opinion, we don't really do anything different from his original vision.
Yeah.
I behave from, like, I guess my creative point of view, exactly like my dad did. I go home and I think about these things, and I come in and I work on them. And I don't ask for other people's permission, and I don't run this past the board of directors and try to make some convincing investment advantage to thesis. Investment thesis as to why this will net us $10 million of revenue at Huawei next year. Like, it's not, that's not a thing we do.
Yeah.
We have our ideas. We shop them around internally, but we also shop them to the customers. Some of them stick to the wall, some of them don't. And you know this really well. It doesn't always matter if it's going to be profitable. What matters is, does it get us some added value beyond what we currently can do today?
Yeah. Well, you don't know it. Nobody knows if a product's going to be profitable. No one can predict the future.
And that is,
or at our competitors.
And that's the great fallacy of that top-down innovation model that you see with a lot of the bigger companies. So, you know, we have competitors who have really great designers, but they can't get their products launched because the marketing team says it's not going to generate enough revenue.
Yeah.
And that's an insane policy.
But they need to pretend to know because they have to justify their jobs.
Yeah. And so I think we can summarize with, if you are one of those engineers working at one of these big companies that we compete with, and if you're sick and tired of the marketing team telling you what your products can and cannot sell to, and whether your ideas are good or not good because the customer did or did not ask, you should give me or Doug a call because we can probably help you.
Careers at markingmicrowaves.com.
I mean, look, if you believe in what we believe, which is that, you know, the innovation comes first, and then if it's valuable, the customers will buy it, then my dad did it, and I'm doing it, and that's why we're doing ICs.